Nick. It's nice to meet you.
For any parent, there is no fear worse than your child disappearing.
See, ain't I beautiful?
Yeah, beautiful blonde hair. Kind of look like a little pixie.
In June 1994, 13-year-old Nicholas Barkley played a game of basketball with his friends in San Antonio, Texas. After the game, Nicholas began walking home, but he never made it home. 3 years later, in 1997, a different and older Nicholas was flown back from Spain after allegedly being rescued from a kidnapping ring. But things were never as they seemed. What really happened to Nicholas, and how did he end up in Spain? Welcome back to M7 Crime Storytime, where we cover solved, unsolved, and twisted cases from around the world. Today, we're looking at the twisted case of Nicholas Barkley. Now, without any further ado, let's dive into the case. Today's story takes us to 1994 San Antonio. It's a city in Bexar County, Texas, USA. With 1.4 million residents in 2020, San Antonio is America's biggest Hispanic-majority city. Despite its size, San Antonio has a comparatively lower homicide rate, with 11.15 homicides per 100,000 residents in 2020, down from 18.3 the previous year, and significantly lower than its peak of 22 in 1993. That same year, the city earned the label Drive-By City due to over 1,200 drive-by shootings recorded by the San Antonio Police Department, fueled by gang violence. In 1993, San Antonio witnessed 230 homicides, its highest since 1991. Despite this, San Antonio is relatively safe, and residents are generally welcoming, as most crimes involve gang members or are domestic. This is the city where Nicholas Barkley lived with his family. Nicholas Patrick Barkley, known affectionately as Nicky, was born on December 31, 1980, in the vibrant city of Salt Lake City, Utah, USA. Born to a single mother, Beverly Dollarhide, Nicholas had a distinctive spirit that set him apart. Beverly had two older children from a previous marriage, a daughter Carrie and a son Jason, both considerably older than Nicholas. Nicholas had light brown hair and blue eyes. Standing at 4 feet 8 inches tall, growing up in San Antonio, Nicholas was surrounded by a mix of urban vibrancy and natural beauty. From a young age, he showed a keen interest in exploring his surroundings and engaging in outdoor activities. However, Nicholas's life was also shaped by his surroundings. His mother's job at a local convenience store required night graveyard shifts, leaving Nicholas to face many hurdles on his own. Diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, also known as ADD, early on, Nicholas's teachers recognized his potential and sought to support him. They contacted Child Protective Services out of concern for his well-being, as they suspected he might be facing abuse. Despite his young age, Nicholas showed impulsive behavior from an early age, leading to multiple encounters with the law. His juvenile criminal record included offenses like breaking and entering, theft, skipping school, and even making threats towards his teachers. Notably, he was also verbally and physically aggressive towards his mother. Due to his troubles, Nicholas had a court appearance on June 14, 1994, which could possibly see him placed in a group home. This transition would mean him sacrificing the independence he cherished. Understandably, this notion did not sit well with Nicholas. But fate had other plans. On June 13, 1994, 13-year-old Nicholas Barkley enjoyed a basketball game with his friends in his hometown of San Antonio, Texas. As he played basketball, Nicholas contacted his older brother Jason for a ride home. However, Jason declined, instructing Nicholas to make his own way back. With only $5 in his possession, Nicholas began his journey home, but he didn't make it. This mundane call was the last interaction his family had with him. That same day, Nicholas's mother, Beverly Dollarhide, reported him missing. Familiar with Nicholas's encounter with the law and his imminent court appearance, authorities initially treated his case as another instance of running away, expecting him to reappear within a day or so. Nicholas was reportedly dressed in a white shirt and purple pants and carrying a distinctive pink backpack. Therefore, the police thought that he'd be easily located and returned home. But they were wrong. In September of that same year, Jason, Nicholas's older brother, reached out to the police, claiming that Nicholas had attempted to break into their garage. Despite Jason's report, when the police arrived, there is no evidence of attempted burglary nor any trace of Nicholas. The uncertainty surrounding his disappearance deepened, leaving more questions than answers. In 1997, after 3 years of being missing, a startling development emerged. Nicholas's family was informed that he'd been located in Linares, Spain. Nicholas's sister, Carrie, mustered the courage, aided by her employer, to journey to Spain, an experience that was her first trip abroad. Convinced that this person was her long-lost brother, she brought him back to San Antonio, warmly welcoming him into her home and even allowing him to share a room with her own son. Upon his return to the United States, Nicholas claimed that he was abducted by high-ranking government officials allegedly involved in an evil child sex ring. According to his story, these operatives subjected him, along with numerous other children, to abuse and experimental procedures that altered his appearance. These experiments purportedly led to the transformation of his blue eyes into brown and a change in his hair color to evade recognition. Nicholas also claimed that his new accent was from living in Europe for 2 years. Understandably, Nicholas's family was elated to have him back after such a long absence. However, upon reuniting, discrepancies emerged that cast doubt on his account. Despite the glaring differences in appearance, with their once blonde-haired and blue-eyed son now presenting as a brown-eyed brunette speaking with a French accent, the family's overwhelming joy overshadowed these surprising changes. Their desire to reunite with their loved one led them to overlook these concerning signals. However, the story didn't end here. Because of his miraculous reappearance, the media wanted to know how it all happened. Around November 1, 1997, shortly after the new Nicholas had settled into his new residence, a private investigator named Charlie Parker, who had an office in San Antonio, caught wind of the astonishing story surrounding the return of 16-year-old Nicholas Barclay and decided to investigate the kidnapping. Parker was in his late 50s at the time, and having harbored dreams of becoming a private investigator, Parker transitioned into the role only recently after spending 3 decades in the lumber and building materials industry. Parker swiftly traced Nicholas Barclay's whereabouts to Carrie and Brian's trailer. On November 6, 1997, accompanied by a producer and camera crew, Parker arrived at the location. Although the family had reservations about Nicholas speaking to the media, Nicholas agreed to an interview. Parker observed from the sidelines as the young man recounted his disturbing story. Parker replied, "He was calm as a cucumber. No looking down, no body language, none." However, Nicholas's peculiar accent piqued Parker's curiosity. After looking at a photograph of young Nicholas Barclay on a shelf, Parker couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. Recalling that ears are unique like fingerprints, he approached the cameraman and quietly requested, "Zoom in on his ears. Get them as close as you can." Placing the photograph of Nicholas Barclay in his pocket, Parker returned to his office post-interview. Using a scanner, he transferred the photo to his computer and meticulously analyzed the interview footage. Parker closely examined the ears in both images. The ears were close, but they didn't match, he recalled.
"We put them in Adobe Photoshop. You know, people laugh about that, but he didn't have the same ear. Well, he couldn't change his ear. A plastic surgeon would have to tear the ear out. So I knew right away I had an imposter."
Parker consulted ophthalmologists, eye experts, about the possibility of changing blue eyes to brown through chemical injections. Their consensus was negative. He also contacted a dialect expert at Trinity University who explained that even after 3 years of captivity, an individual would quickly revert to their original accent. Despite San Antonio police claiming that the returned individual was Nicholas Barclay, Parker shared his doubts with authorities. Concerned that a potential imposter was residing with the Barclay family, he reached out to Beverly, revealing his discoveries. Parker explained the inconsistencies regarding his ears, eyes, and accent. Parker's record stated, "Family's upset, but maintains that they believe it's their son." A few days later, an angry call from Nicholas followed, although he denied making it. Parker recorded in his files that Nicholas challenged, "Who do you think you are?" When Parker expressed his disbelief in Nicholas's identity, Nicholas retorted, "Immigration thinks it's me. The family thinks it's me." Parker pondered whether to let the matter go. After all, he'd already alerted authorities and wasn't obligated to investigate further. Plus, other cases demanded his attention. However, the boy's French-tinged accent lingered in his thoughts, prompting questions about a foreigner infiltrating a Texas trailer home. "I thought he was a terrorist, I swear to God," Parker recalled. Beverly secured a modest room in a dilapidated San Antonio apartment complex, and Parker began tailing Nicholas during his visits. "I'd set up in the apartment and watch him come out," Parker recounted. Nicholas's routine included walks to the bus stop adorned with a Walkman and mimicking Michael Jackson's dance moves. After spending 2 months in the United States, Nicholas became increasingly moody and distant. He started skipping classes, prompting taunts from fellow students who teased him about his unusual accent. This resulted in his suspension. By December, he embarked on a solitary journey in Carrie's car, driving to Oklahoma. The police arrested him for speeding, but his family bailed him out from the police station and took him back home. Shortly before Christmas, Nicholas noticed his altered appearance in the bathroom mirror, his brown eyes and dyed hair. Angry, he grabbed a razor and cut his face. This act led him to being confined in a local hospital psychiatric ward for observation. Doctors eventually deemed him stable enough to return to Carrie's trailer, yet his anxiety continued. In the midst of these events, doubts regarding Nicholas's account began to surface among the authorities. An experienced FBI agent, Nancy Fisher, interviewed Nicholas several weeks after arriving in the United States. The purpose was to document his claims of being kidnapped on American soil.
"I was pulling teeth trying to determine who would kidnap Nicholas, when and where and under what circumstances. I had almost no information because all the information he gave us was very, very general. He couldn't give names, he couldn't give places, he couldn't give times, he couldn't give anything."
Fisher instantly felt suspicious, recalling, "His hair was dark but bleached blonde, and the roots were quite obvious." Charlie Parker knew Fisher and had already shared his suspicions with her. Fisher cautioned Parker against interfering with an ongoing federal investigation. However, their parallel inquiries led to a sense of collaboration and trust, with Parker sharing any important information he gathered. While Fisher delved into potential abductors and abusers, she found Nicholas's demeanor towards her peculiar, describing him as surly and uncooperative. Fisher's primary concern was getting to know who this new Nicholas who had entered the U.S. was. She recognized the impossibility of altering eye color and decided to seek expert help. Fisher arranged for Nicholas to see a forensic psychiatrist in Houston under the pretense of addressing his alleged abuse. The psychiatrist, based on Nicholas's syntax and grammar, concluded that he couldn't be American and was more likely French or Spanish. Fisher shared these findings with Beverly and Carrie, but they remained resolute in their belief that he was Nicholas. Suspecting Nicholas might be a spy, Fisher reached out to the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, voicing her concerns and seeking assistance in identifying him. However, she recalls the CIA's response, stating, "I was told by a CIA agent that until you can prove he's European, we can't help you." Fisher attempted to convince Beverly and Nicholas to provide blood samples for a DNA test. Both adamantly refused. Beverly, in particular, was vehement in her resistance, declaring, "How dare you say he's not my son?"
"Mrs. Dollarhide said, 'This is my son. I don't have to provide blood samples for you for DNA.' And she laid down on the floor, literally laid down on the floor, and said, 'No, and you can't pick me up and you can't make me.'"
By February 1998, 4 months into Nicholas's presence in the U.S., Fisher obtained warrants to compel their cooperation. She recollects Beverly lying on the floor, refusing to comply. Despite the resistance, Fisher managed to obtain their blood samples. She also acquired Nicholas's fingerprints, forwarding them to the State Department for a potential match with Interpol records. Meanwhile, concerned about Nicholas's self-destructive tendencies and instability, Carrie decided she could no longer host him, leading him to move in with Beverly in her apartment. During this time, Nicholas began to reevaluate his interactions with his family. On March 5, 1998, as authorities drew closer to arresting Nicholas, Beverly made an important call to Parker, claiming that her son Nicholas was an imposter. Acting on this information, Parker met Nicholas at a diner the following morning, hoping to establish a relaxed atmosphere. They ordered hotcakes, and after nearly 5 months of his return, Nicholas Barkley was tired. Parker recounted how he informed Nicholas that he'd upset his mother, to which Nicholas unexpectedly blurted out, "She's not my mother, and you know it." Parker pressed further, asking, "Are you going to tell me who you are?" Nicholas's response was candid. "I'm Frederick Bourdin, and I'm wanted by Interpol."
My heart was beating fast, just like it is now thinking about it. And I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm Frederick Bourdin, and I'm wanted by Interpol."
Parker excused himself to the restroom and promptly contacted Nancy Fisher with the revelation. Fisher, who just received the same information from Interpol, urged Parker to stall Bourdin, who'd been masquerading as Nicholas for almost 5 months while they worked on obtaining a warrant. Returning to the table, Parker sustained the conversation with Bourdin. As Bourdin recounted tales of his nomadic European life, Parker wrestled with some guilt for his role in exposing him. After about an hour, Parker drove Bourdin back to Beverly's apartment. Parker left, but Fisher and law enforcement were already en route to apprehend Bourdin. He surrendered without resistance. "I knew I was Frederick Bourdin again," he admitted. Beverly's reaction was less composed. Upon seeing Fisher, she exclaimed in frustration, "What took you so long?"
"Settle in tonight, because we are about to share with you a story so bizarre it's hard to believe it's true. This is the tale of a master imposter who managed to lie his way into the United States and prey upon the most vulnerable of people."
Frédéric Pierre Bourdin was born on June 13, 1974, in Nanterre, France. Bourdin's early life was marked by unique circumstances. Raised by his grandparents in Nantes, he ventured on a journey of independence, eventually finding his way to Paris. The absence of his father, an Algerian immigrant named Cassie, according to his mother, further added to the complexity of his upbringing and personal history. In October 1997, Frédéric Bourdin found himself in a dire situation in Spain. Faced with the possibility of being exposed as an adult with a criminal record, he devised an audacious plan to evade capture, assuming the identity of a missing teenager. Bourdin believed that if he could convince the authorities and the missing boy's family that he was indeed a teenager from the United States, he might escape legal consequences. His plan involved stealing the identity of Nicholas Barkley, a missing 16-year-old from Texas. In the middle of the night, Bourdin hatched a plan. He called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in the U.S., using English he'd picked up during his travels, and posed as a director of the Spanish shelter where he was staying. He described a frightened child who resembled him and asked if they had anyone matching that description. Astonishingly, the center suggested the missing boy might be Nicholas Barkley, who had disappeared in 1994. This unforeseen twist led Bourdin to commit further to his deception. With a makeshift plan and an altered appearance, Bourdin called the officer in charge of Nicholas Barkley's case, claiming that the missing boy had been found.
"Something in my head decided I could do it, that I had to try." I took the phone and I told her that,
"This is Nicholas. We got him. It's him. It's incredible. It's him."
This marked the beginning of Bourdin's attempt to convince the authorities and the family that he was indeed Nicholas. He fabricated stories about his appearance changes, concocting a narrative of abduction and experimentation that might explain his altered eye color. Now in custody, Bourdin told another elaborate tale that was as imaginative as his Nicholas Barkley impersonation. He suggested that Beverly and Jason might have played a role in the real Nicholas's disappearance, and that they were aware of his deceit from the start. Bourdin's words were laden with irony as he acknowledged, "I'm a good imposter, but I'm not that good." Before his disappearance, the real Nicholas had been living with Beverly in a modest one-story house in San Antonio. His older half-brother, Jason, age 24, had recently moved in after a stint with his cousin in Utah. Jason has a wiry build, long curly brown hair, and an ever-present comb tucked in his jeans back pocket. He bore burn scars from an accident at 13 when he accidentally set himself on fire while lighting a cigarette near gasoline. These scars created an enduring fear of isolation. Carrie remembered that Jason worried that he'd never meet someone and he'd always be alone. Despite his struggles, he displayed artistic talents, sketching portraits of friends and strumming Lynyrd Skynyrd songs on his guitar. Although he'd only completed high school, he was articulate and bright. Yet, he grappled with his own demons, frequently engaging in heavy drinking and cocaine use, traits he shared with his mother. After Nicholas's disappearance, Jason's behavior grew increasingly erratic. He was arrested for assaulting a police officer, and Beverly expelled him from the house. According to Carrie, Nicholas's disappearance had a profound impact on Jason, leading him into a spiral of drug addiction. His family claimed that he was suffering from guilt because he didn't help Nicholas to get a ride home on the day he vanished. In late 1996, Jason decided to face his addiction and entered a rehabilitation center, ultimately succeeding in overcoming his drug dependency. Following his rehabilitation program, he remained at the facility for over a year, serving as a counselor and working for the center's landscaping business. He was still there when Baudin appeared as Nicholas. He questioned why Jason hadn't met him at the airport and initially showed no eagerness to meet him at Carrie's place. After about a month and a half, Jason finally paid a visit to the new Nicholas. Carrie described Jason's demeanor as standoffish during the encounter. Although Jason hugged his brother in front of everyone, Baudin sensed an air of caution in his embrace. After a brief interaction, Jason asked him to step outside and extended a hand toward him, presenting a necklace with a golden cross. Jason explained that it was for him. Baudin shared, "It was like he had to give it to me." Jason placed the necklace around the new Nicholas's neck and then bid him farewell and never returned. Baudin recounted, "It was evident that Jason knew what had happened to Nicholas." For the first time, Baudin began to ponder who was truly deceiving whom. After Baudin moved in with Beverly, he noticed peculiar instances, like Beverly's reserved reception at the airport and Jason's reluctance to visit him. While Carrie and Brian seemed committed to believing he was Nicholas, disregarding blatant discrepancies, Nicholas felt Beverly treated him less like a son and more like a ghost. He alleged that during one episode while staying with her, Beverly, in a drunken state, had exclaimed, "I know that God punished me by sending you to me. I don't know who the hell you are. Why the f*** are you doing this?" Beverly couldn't recall such an incident, but remarked, "He must have got me pissed off." Eventually, Frederick Baudin, the Nicholas Barclay impersonator, was charged in court. In September 1998, Baudin entered a guilty plea for passport fraud and perjury in a San Antonio federal court. He was handed a 6-year prison sentence, surpassing the recommended duration outlined in the sentencing guidelines. After his sentence, he was deported to France. Upon his return to Europe in 2003, Baudin quickly resumed his fraudulent activities, assuming various false identities of other teenagers. This pattern of impersonation led to his incarceration once more. Among others, he adopted the persona of Léo Bally, a 14-year-old French boy missing since 1996. However, even this elaborate transformation couldn't escape scientific scrutiny. DNA testing ultimately exposed the falsehood and he was sentenced to prison. In 2007, he married a French woman and reportedly became a father to 5 children. However, subsequent social media posts hinted at the potential dissolution of the marriage. A 2008 profile in The New Yorker revealed Baudin's claim of being too famous, and he even boasted of adopting around 500 different identities, showcasing the extent of his deceptive endeavors. Despite ongoing efforts by private investigators, the case of Nicholas Barclay went cold, leaving his whereabouts a mystery. Tragically, he's never been located, and his fate remains unknown. Suspicion has surrounded his older brother Jason as a potential suspect in his disappearance. However, Jason struggled with drug addiction following Nicholas's vanishing and tragically passed away from a cocaine overdose in 1998. With his untimely death, the investigation hit a roadblock. To this day, Nicholas Barclay's case remains unresolved, with law enforcement agencies often categorizing him as a runaway. The circumstances surrounding his disappearance and the lingering questions surrounding his family's involvement continue to perplex and haunt those seeking answers. In 2012, Netflix produced a documentary called The Imposter, highlighting Nicholas Barclay's and Frederick Baudin's story. Frederick Baudin once said, "When you fight monsters, be careful that you don't become one." Perhaps Baudin couldn't defeat his monsters and decided to become one. Frederick Baudin's remarkable saga underscores the complexity of human deception and the lengths people can go to assume false identities, even when it harms others. What do you think? Do you think that Frederick Boldin's sentence was adequate for his crimes? What do you think would have been the perfect punishment for him? Let us know what you think in the comment section. Until next time, stay safe.